Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. Cyberbullying can affect adults just as much as it affects kids. Adults, especially those in positions of power or in the public eye, are often targets. The people on the other side of the keyboard can be called keyboard warriors, internet trolls, and the list goes on. So today, we're going to talk about the impacts this has on adults. We'll welcome a Champlain College professor and a UVM professor to discuss the emotional, psychophysiological, and behavioral responses caused by cyberbullying. But first, few people experience the power of social media more profoundly than those targeted by online hate. And a new feature-length documentary examines the toll those attacks can take on people they attempt to harm. The film is called Backlash: Misogyny in the Digital Age, and it features a former Vermont lawmaker named Kaya Morris, who left office after becoming the target of racist and sexist attacks online. Here's a clip of Morris speaking about those attacks on the film.
There were always a few things that might pop up here or there, but nothing on a scale of what I started to experience in 2016 during my reelection campaign.
The film makes its U.S. debut at a screening at the Vermont State House this coming Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. Find details on our website if you'd like to attend. Morris now serves as executive director of Rights and Democracy, and she spoke with my colleague, State House reporter Peter Hirschfeld, about her participation in the documentary and what she's hoping viewers will take away from the experience.
The film includes some explicit examples of the threats and harassment that you and other women experienced, and it takes viewers to some very uncomfortable places. What is the value, do you think, in painting such a visceral portrait of this trauma and suffering?
I mean, when you're watching these stories, when you're hearing about what happened, when you're seeing the reactions, you're seeing the emotions that are still on the surface for so many, it forces us to reckon with the places that we may have been willfully ignoring because it might be triggering for ourselves, that it might implicate ourselves as a society, and that it makes the enormity of the issue feel untenable, at least as far as finding a resolution. So the visceralness of what is presented is the reality that each of us was experiencing. You cannot sugarcoat that any less than I would do any other act of violence. So it is great courage that was on the part of everyone to participate in a project that took years to actually be developed and to continually step back into being willing to tell that story one more time so that we could get the fullness of it in a way that we might not in a newspaper article or in a quick conversation.
For people that have experienced anything akin to what the people featured in this film have gone through, they don't need a documentary, obviously, to tell them what this looks like and how it makes people feel. For people that have not been through that experience, what are you hoping they take away by watching this film?
At a minimum, they can start asking questions because there's also an assumption that it's just a few that are experiencing this. And one of the reasons why I felt it was important to have this first screening take place in Vermont and at the State House in front of so many was to highlight the fact that many of my former peers are experiencing this, that there's people that are running for office. And I constantly am faced with that question from folks around their safety. Is there a place where they can find safety? How can they be safe? Because they know that there's an inevitability to the harassment. In this time, in this day, the way that it is working on the internet, the just unfettered access that people have to manipulate social media, it's an inevitability. It is happening probably to your niece who's in high school. It is happening probably to that activist that you knew from college. It is happening all over. And how are we responding and even asking those questions. What is it like and how can I support you?
You just talked about the extent to which this is already happening across Vermont to people whose names have not been splashed across the headlines as yours was. In what ways is this affecting our political, cultural, and social landscape?
Yeah, it is. It's part of a, I believe, a very organized campaign to disrupt our democracy at a fundamental level. If people are afraid to run for office, or if they choose to step away, which we saw happen. We saw happen in the years following my departure from the legislature, even here in Vermont, that there were many women of color who stepped up to say, I want to run. It can be done. Many of those women are no longer in their elected seats. There was a calculated decision that it was not worth it. It was not worth it to know that they were going in service to their communities and to the state and would not be protected. That was an afterthought or a nice to have rather than a fundamental component of ensuring that they would be able to serve to their best, to have the political courage they need to represent their people the way that they had campaigned to do and to engage in the political process. So as we're actually even going into this new biennium, many of the bills that are coming up that have to do with violence, they have to do with gun violence, they have to do with hatred, they have to do with bias, they have to do with harassment. There's a calculated decision upon who is going to sponsor these bills because those individuals become targets. We've seen it where youth in Vermont have been targeted, teachers have been targeted for teaching education, teaching accurate history, teaching about gender identity and giving our children a sense of pride and knowledge and understanding the world around them, and have been distinctly targeted in organized campaigns across the nation. We're on Fox News's radar for a place to consistently come and lift up as an enemy of their agenda. And that results in real threats and real violence for people here in Vermont and across the country.
There's a part in the film where Sarah Roberts, who's a scholar who specializes in content moderation on social media platforms, says that because social media is a relatively recent technological phenomenon, we don't know yet what kind of societal and cultural consequences will result from online bullying and harassment like we're seeing right now.
Like, what happens, for example, when you grow up online being desensitized to misogyny? We have a whole generation of people who are in the process of growing up with these platforms. We don't know who they'll be or how these things will impact them on the other side just yet.
So, Kaya Morris, I'll ask you, where do you think this road takes us?
I think it only gets worse, quite honestly. It has become such a prominent part of regular conversation and discourse that it would be difficult to undo. It has to be addressed, but I do worry that it's only going to continue to amplify as time goes by. We've become very comfortable post-pandemic with receiving all of our information online, with creating memes and quick catchphrases and coming up with distilled down ideologies in a way that's very dangerous. And it gets repeated without check. It gets repeated without verification. It's just a point of resonance that then goes viral. And there are such few mechanisms for us as individuals to protect ourselves from becoming those targets and even sometimes engaging in the rhetoric without even meaning to do so. I am definitely concerned about that, and I'm not even sure what the solution is, as the best efforts have not moved the biggest players within our social media world, within our online spaces, to take any meaningful action.
You just said you don't know what the solution is. I want to see if you're willing to offer any thoughts on that front, because that's the big question this film leaves us with, right? if this unchecked aggression is causing so much harm, what are we going to do about it?
It's going to be that horrible balance that I feel. I once heard Mary McCord, who is a researcher that also does great work looking at online communities and such, talking about the fact that we get into a battle over what's free speech and what's not free speech, what's harassment and what is just an expression from an individual. And the thing is that we're constantly making a calculated decision about whose speech is free speech and whose speech is harmful. We are constantly making a decision. So as much as we want to fear questioning whether or not the First Amendment is all-encompassing and all-protective, we make those choices all the time, and we have to interrogate that. We have to look at, and it's terrible that we have to use creating a criminality. We have to create a crime in order to try to address this, but there has to come a place where we redefine what harassment is. And I'm excited for the work that I'm hearing coming out of the Human Rights Commission and some of the other places in Vermont here that are looking at the severe and pervasive standard that's constantly used and keeps folks from ever getting access to justice. And that doesn't mean that every case is going to be winnable. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to receive the justice, but they don't even get an opportunity to pursue any remedy because there is a requirement that the only acts that can be worthy of us taking a public, having a public response to are the ones that are the most egregious and the most severe, when we know that it does not take anything to that scale to terrorize a community. It does not take anything to that scale to create trauma and harm for an individual or their family or their community.
One of the things that this film does particularly effectively is show that this is a global phenomenon, that anywhere people have access to social media, we're going to see this kind of online bullying take place. Do you think there's anything about Vermont that makes us more susceptible to that? And conversely, are there aspects to this state that put us in a position to address it in a different or better way?
Well, so starting from if I was to think about the ways that we're more vulnerable, the vulnerability comes in that the online space is often the testing ground for determining what can happen in the physical space, right? So the online space is the way to say, how does that person respond? Does law enforcement care? How does the community respond? Is there going to be any sort of a safety net or protective system if we are to target these individuals? And that litmus test gives a way for folks to then say, all right, now what will we do in the physical space? We'll start creating militia centers. We'll start creating these groups where people are able to go and participate in taking that online hate into the physical plane, into our everyday lives. What is challenging around that is that we don't necessarily, again, have a way of either tracking what's happening with that, not efficiently or effectively assessing the threat in a real way, and not just, again, the most worst case scenario where even at sometimes having something as direct as saying, I want to kill you, may still not get you the protection or the response that you need as an individual, or the understanding, I think, of the depth of how complex this is, I think makes Vermont vulnerable and has made Vermont vulnerable for a very long time. I mean, it is important to know it doesn't just live online. It then floats into the real world. It floats into our everyday encounters and experiences. It absolutely is something that, in fact, impacts the lives of Vermonters all the time. We do have an opportunity to see, to test our systems and their ability and their readiness and willingness to address this issue. And because of the size of our state, we can see the results faster, but it actually requires that there is a willingness to do so. It requires that there is full cooperation. And we know that that's not necessarily the case. We know that that is not something that is universally understood or felt. And so one person's experience with this harassment in one community will be very different than it will be in another. And that is where the disparities make it very difficult to say how we will progress, how we will improve.
So the film is going to be screened on February 7th in Montpelier at the State House and will be immediately followed by a panel discussion at which some pretty prominent folks in Vermont are going to be talking about what they saw, putting it into context. I assume that's meant to be the beginning of a conversation out of this film. Where do you see that conversation going in the future?
I hope it raises really important questions, and it also kind of puts a little bit of feet to the fire with regards to those that are trying to put in policies, that are looking at systems that need change. I hope it gets folks galvanized around creating demand. So it's not just on the person that's experiencing this to have to be the one to advocate for this change, but that it is us as a state saying we're not able to function like this and a solution must be met. So I think this conversation is going to give some really important perspectives and lived experiences, and as well as being able to kind of name where we're falling short and the possibilities for the future.
Kaya Morris, thank you for your time. Any thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
While the historical components of this story may be a few years older, the impacts for myself personally have not abated. I still need to live a life of vigilance around security. I am still deeply cognizant of the impact that my presence has, even on those that I work with, those who are employed by my organization, those who are a part of my movement, my friends. It is something that, again, may have a date stamp on it because it was in a place where we were able to document that. But it's still there. And it's not just there for me, it's there for everyone. Everyone who's experienced this. It hurts my heart to know how many others are continually dealing with this harassment, almost in silence. We'll have an outrage for about 24 hours. And then we forget about the person on the other side. And we keep moving forward without ever coming back to making sure that they're secure. Beyond that moment of trauma, beyond that moment of acknowledgement that we don't feel safe here.
That was Vermont Public reporter Peter Hirschfeld interviewing former Vermont lawmaker Kaya Morris about the new documentary she's appearing in called Backlash, Misogyny in the Digital Age. The film is screening at the Vermont State House this coming Tuesday, February 7th. Find the trailer for that film and a link to register for the screening on our website, vermontpublic.org. The world of bullying has changed since many of us were kids. Traditionally, we think of being bullied, we think of back to the playground or recess. But now, both adults and kids have to navigate a world with people we know and we don't know attacking us online. These attacks can come in the form of social media posts, direct messages, text messages, emails, and whole websites made to bully and harass someone. We just heard a powerful interview with former lawmaker Kaya Morris about her experience, and now we're going to slightly shift gears and look at how cyberbullying, which seems to be too light of a term in many cases, affects adults both in their private lives and in their workplace. We'll dive into what's happening in the brain and ways to help you cope should you find yourself the victim. Our guest today is Champlain College professor and co-program director of psychology at Champlain College. She studies psychophysiological and behavioral responses from cyberbullying. Professor Colombo, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today.
Now, Professor Colombo, I first just want to start and get your reaction to what you just heard in that interview with Kaya Morris and my colleague Peter Hirschfeld.
So that was really, really interesting because a lot of the keywords that I heard were used really resonate with me and with the research that I have been conducting. There was a lot of talk about empathy and building a safe space. And that is really something that resonates deeply with me because what seems to work in helping victims of cyberbullying is when there is a safe space that they can refer to. And many times for people, especially people that are parts of any minorities, this is not something that can be given for granted. And that makes the effect of cyberbullying and harassment 10 times worse. The other thing that
Go ahead.
And the other thing that stuck with me was the stress on the word empathy, because empathy is the power that we have to try and stop or minimize it, because this emerged a lot in the research has been done with kids, but has been proven to work with adults as well. Teaching and increasing empathy towards victims and make people understand that cyberbullying is a hate crime, is harmful behavior, will help creating this safe environment and provide support and not support the haters or the trollers that can be damaging and causing harm to other people.
Now, Professor Colombo, many of us, if not all of us, have experienced some kind of bullying as probably both kids and adults. How does face-to-face bullying differ from cyberbullying in terms of
With the face-to-face, something that stuck as a difference, that is something that you just mentioned a few minutes ago, we can see who is attacking us. And many times the response from the bystanders that can help the victim is more straightforward. It's easier to stand up and help the victim. It's easier to support the victim because it's something that is happening and that you can actually see. With cyberbullying, the person who is harassing as the protection of anonymity many times. And that increases the opportunity and also gives a lot of courage to a cyberbully to be able to attack their victims. And one of the differences when you look at the profile of bullies that operate in person or use different forms of media, like as you were mentioning, public media like Twitter or Instagram or more private ways of communication, is that usually they don't have that social status linked with power that is typical of bullies that operate in person. Many times they are people, they're lonely themselves or in a situation where they don't have a lot of power or they don't have a lot of control over their own environment. And then the media and the internet provides a form of locus of control to say a place where they can have the illusion of being in control. And this is very sad, but unfortunately this harmful behavior is what they use as a way of control or as a way of taking their revenge against something that thing caused their negative situation, namely loneliness or not being in control of their life as they would like.
And Professor Colombo, what does the research tell us about how adults are affected by cyberbullying in terms of what's happening in the brain?
Yeah, so our brain responds to cyberbullying, which is, just as a reminder, an intentionally harmful behavior that happens repeatedly over time. So our brain responds to that as it would respond to any form of trauma. And so the negative effects that we can see, we can record them at three different levels. The most common, the easiest to spot are psychological and emotional. So we can see an increase in depression, anxiety, and in some cases, even suicidal ideation and attempts. And then there are some behavioral components, and people, adults who are victim of harassment and cyberbullying tend to adopt behaviors that bring them to be more isolated because they fear being the presence of others, especially when they're attacked repeatedly. And of course, this isolation goes against the idea of having a safe and space and a support network that would be what would help them. So the behavior basically bring the people more far from the help they could get. And then they're also, and this is especially related to work performance, a more cognitive effect. We know in children and teenagers, they're victims of bullying, that their academic performance get worse. But the same is true for adults on the workplace. Their performance is worse, and also their job satisfaction is worse. That, of course, is positively related to their performance.
So when when somebody opens a tweet, when they read a tweet, an email, a direct message, what is really happening to them emotionally? Is it the tweet that affects them itself, or like how do we respond to that?
So this is an interesting question that might be more complicated than it sounds, because actually the way each individual responds depend a lot on who they are and their history. There is some research that shows how history regarding mental health, history of past trauma, or your community will predict the way you will emotionally respond to cyberbullying. So if you're part, for example, of a minority, you will have a more enhanced emotional response. And if your history within the minority has been characterized by negative experiences, those emotional responses will be stronger. If you have a past history of trauma, even if it's not been caused, has not been caused by cyberbullying, but for any reason, the tweet or the personal message or the email that you get trigger something that's related to any form of past trauma, then your response will be much, much higher to that. So it's hard to say. I cannot predict how everyone will respond to cyberbullying, because it really depends on who that person is.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. That's Scott Mitchell, school board chair at Bellows Free Academy in Fairfax. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Connor.
So we're here to talk about the growing amount of online harassment targeting members of the school board, and specifically around issues with Bellows Free Academy in Fairfax. Now, you noticed a change during the pandemic, and it's only gotten worse. What has happened?
Well, it's been happening for quite some time, right? With the prevalence of social media, new ways of communication, there's way more ways for people to voice their opinion. Over the pandemic, we saw people getting isolated in their own little bubbles and own little media outlets, so that they were only ingesting what their viewpoint was. And when we started to go back to in-person meetings and more getting to know people better, we were seeing a increase in online and email interaction that was a little less than constructive.
Now, our show is about harassment online and being mindful that we don't want to add to anyone's sense of being targeted. Can you give us specific examples of what kind of harassment board members have been getting?
Well, it stems from a few different things. We had, masking mandates, which were controversial. We flew the Black Lives Matter flag. Most recently, Fairfax has passed a $36 million bond, and it has escalated in each successive thing that's come about that's controversial. Most recently would be the bond and interactions with the board, both through Facebook and email, that have at one point actually caused us to step up security at our in-person meetings as well.
So what, if any, solutions have you and the school board found to get through this?
It has come to a point where the school board doesn't interact on social media. We use social media as a one-way communication tool. So we don't get into online debates. We try to provide information as best we can, but we don't do the back and forth that you will typically see in a social media post.
Now, before we let you go, Scott, BFA Fairfax has been one of many Vermont schools that finds itself dealing with harassment and racism at school sporting events. Currently, BFA Fairfax has banned fans at high school basketball games as the school district investigates allegations that a spectator used the N-word towards one or several Milton High School athletes after a game in late January. That's according to 7 Days. How is the learning community responding to these incidents?
I mean, the community in general is responding fine. I do know that, and from a school board perspective, we don't see it as much as our administrators and teachers do. There have been, you know, anonymous emails sent once we banned fans from games to administrators in a negative aspect. So, you know, we're looking to get spectators back as soon as possible and hoping to do that within the next week or so. But again, the negative impact to administrators and teachers is really what our focus is in trying to keep them in a mind space that isn't detrimental to them or the students.
Now, oh, I just want to ask one more question. As somebody on the school board, what is your advice to parents that find themselves frustrated with maybe some of what the school board is doing, and how can they constructively voice their criticisms?
Most talk to us. You know, we have meetings every month. We have email. But coming and talking to us face to face at a meeting, in a coffee shop, we're a small community. It's not, you put a post online and think it's anonymous. That can be backhauled and actually found out who the person is. But having a constructive conversation and also keeping an open mind that your opinion is not the only opinion or necessarily the right opinion in every case. There is a lot of gray. It's not just black and white.
That's Scott Mitchell, school board chair at Bellows Free Academy of Fairfax. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Connor.
And Professor Colombo, as you heard Scott's story about what's happening at Bellows Free Academy, how does that resonate with maybe some of the research that you've done?
I found it interesting. One study that we did just after the pandemic might add some more information to understand what has been going on. We examine the level of moral disengagement that young adults have towards different behaviors that goes against social or moral rules. And as a lucky coincidence, we had data from before the pandemic on how students will respond from a psychophysiological way and just a cognitive way to by seeing that those rules were broken. And what we find out that is after the pandemic, it seems to be easier for young adults to get morally disengaged. So it's easier to say, yeah, maybe it's wrong, but it doesn't really matter. While before there was a higher level of empathy, this is really wrong and this might be harmful for the people involved in that situation. And the isolation that we all have been going through might explain this change in the behavior that is not just cognitive. It's not something our participants were saying. We were recording their physiological activation, and we could see that their physiological emotional response to something that was bad was not as high as it was before a pandemic.
And I want to bring one more voice into the conversation, Kimberly Van Est. She's a professor and chair of UVM's Education Department. Professor Van Est, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Professor Van Est, your research points to evidence that says how people use social media is leading to changes in real life interactions and behavior. How so?
Well, first I want to say that this work was also done by Christina Jeffrey and Corey Peltier, so that they get credit for the research. And I think that as people are spending more and more time online and engaging socially in that way, they are less likely to be engaging with one another physically or face to face. And that level of anonymity and also exposure to larger numbers of people to give social feedback to has some risk associated with it.
Now, one of the interesting things I found in one of your research papers that you co-authored says that we need to stop asking, how do we stop this behavior, and instead focus on preparing people, including kids, for a culture characterized by this kind of behavior. So are you implying with that, that and your co-authors, that there is no way to stop this?
Well, I don't know that I'm saying there's no way to stop this, and I think it's a both and scenario, but at least 16% of students in grades 9 through 12, for example, experience cyberbullying, according to National Crime Victimization Surveys and the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey by the Center for Disease Control. And I'm guessing, based on your last guest comment about school situations, that this is an increasing number. That data comes from 2019. So this is something that is really pervasive for adults, children, anyone on social media, and we are not talking enough about what to do with it when it happens, and maybe even how to prepare for it, depending on the level of engagement you have online and the types of topics you engage with.
And Professor Colombo, what can you tell us about where we're headed, and is there really any way to stop online bullying?
Yeah, so there are a lot of programs that have been used mainly with young adults and children that they've tried to use with adults as well to stop or minimize cyberbullying. But there's still not a lot of research on the efficacy of those. There is a hope because there are some factors that appears to be common between bullying in kids and bullying for adults. And that is the response and emotional response of bystanders. And a lot of the intervention for bullying and cyberbullying for children that is based on recruiting the bystanders to help and provide support for the victims seems to be very effective. If the bystanders for adults respond in the same way, we have hope that the same type of intervention can be effective for adults as well.
Professor Van Est, let's talk about ways to address harm of cyberbullying. Now, you worked on a study with self-reported victims of trolling and cyberbully abuse. What did you do with that group to address the impact of harassment?
Sure. We solicited participants online through a single tweet and a single post on Reddit, and we asked folks that had been experiencing either cyberbullying, which is typically a targeted attack, or trolling, which is a little more anonymous and maybe about a social issue, but is fairly random and the people are usually unknown to one another. And then we walked them through some online videos to talk about things like how to normalize and rationalize what was happening, to teach observation skills and predictability for dealing with bullies because the patterns tend to be very predictable, to teach options for how to disconnect, and also to focus on self-power and boundaries. And then what we found was the participants self-reported that this is a powerful intervention for them, that it helped them, that they felt they were more confident and they felt that they had better tools. Interestingly and not more specific ratings about anxiety, though, did not go down in the way that we had hoped. So these are two different things. People may feel more confident about dealing with cyberbullies or trolls and have more skills, but that still doesn't mitigate the anxiety and the harm that is caused by this behavior.
And Professor Colombo, what can you tell us, piggybacking off of what we just heard, about the power of empowering people who feel or who have fallen victim to cyberbullying?
That sounds like a great approach because some of the emotional and behavioral damage that has been reported is linked to the fact that people feel they don't have any power over their attack. And then the response in the brain is to emotionally try to protect and from this by showing anxiety and asking indirectly the victim to run away and get more isolated. So the more empowerment you can provide to the victim, the better they can fight the emotional, behavioral, and cognitive damage that can derive by being attacked by cyberbullying. And the fact that, if I can suggest my own reading, the fact that anxiety didn't go down as fast as expected is because probably it takes more time for the brain to reorganize anything that is emotionally processed and so linked to fear and potential damage. But everything points to direction that is definitely is going to help.
We got a tweet from Sandy who writes, "It's not only politicians who are bullied and threatened. Pedestrians are as well. Everything from circumcision to transgender care, among other issues, are being used to make threats. It's a nationwide, but it's also here in Vermont." And now as we talk about not pedestrians, pediatricians, my bad. Sorry about that. But as we talk about all of this, what's the difference in response from men, women, and even people in marginalized groups? Professor Van Est, I'll start with you. What can you tell us about how individuals respond?
Well, I don't know any data on differences in responding, but I would say that there are certain groups of individuals who are at greater risk for experiencing these kinds of behaviors, and they get layered on. So they may be already in a position where they're fighting against systemic racism, and this is one more thing. And so it definitely has an impact on the ability for people to step up and lead, as your earlier guests talked about. And it also creates places where people become more isolated. And I think that also has an additive and negative effect.
And Professor Colombo, when we talk about, you know, the difference between men and women and marginalized groups, what do you know, and what does your research tell you about how people respond differently?
Yeah, the data that I have seems to point out that women tend to respond at more emotional levels. So those emotional effects that I mentioned before, like anxiety and depression, tends to be more pronounced in women, who also are the ones that tend not to report being harassed or being victim of cyberbullying. And then some other research that I did was on aging LGBTQ plus population in New England. And in that case, it looks like harassment that goes over time seems to affect their behavior in a way that prevents them to share what they've been experiencing, and that affect their general health. Because if you don't feel safe to share what has been going on, for example, with your medical provider, then you will not maybe able to get the care and the support that you need. And for aging population, we know that that's important.
Professor Van Nest, as Kaya Morris said in an interview at the beginning of the show, online trolls and harassers have few restrictions. Technology makes them often anonymous and have free speech protections that so far have not found this harassment criminal. How do we make people accountable?
Well, accountability is also a little bit out of the realm of the types of things I study, but I would say that there are things that we can do to help the self-advocacy, confidence, and power of the people who are experiencing these things. School districts can have policies around cyberbullying and trolling that are different from physical in-person bullying. I think that's really important because it's such a 24/7 pervasive part of life that our students and teachers and pediatricians can't necessarily get away from those harassing activities. I also think, because this is hard to notice, that we might do a better job as adults and colleagues and peers, even in schools, of checking in with one another regularly. We're almost all on social media at some platform, some level. And how do we check in with one another to see if people are okay and if they're experiencing anything so that we can normalize this. Because if you go out into public in the world that is the internet, you are likely to encounter this. And then I'd also say that you can turn off alerts on your phone. So the anxiety provoking alerts that flash up to let you know people are responding or how they're responding, or the fear and anxiety that comes with checking one of your social media accounts to see how people responded to a post. Turning those things off, being in a place where you are mentally and emotionally prepared to read what people are putting out there about you or about something you said, and having some resilience and some safety net, some safe people around you to support you is an important way, I think, on our end to prevent the negative impacts.
Professor Colombo, this hour has gone by really fast. In the last 30 seconds, what advice do you have for people who find themselves the victim of cyberbullying, and how can they cope?
Trying to find your own supportive environment, find some friends, find someone that you can trust, and be really open to that, to them about what's going on. And if you need to do it by yourself, or if you have a support network, report what's going on, because increasing awareness will make even the victims feel better. And I think finding a safe environment, finding people around you that can support you is really the key first step. Proof.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank my guest, Champlain College Professor Barbara Colombo. Professor Colombo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Connor.
I also want to thank UVM Professor and Chair of UVM's Education Department, Kimberly Van Est. Professor Van Est, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
That's it for today's show. Today's show was directed by James Stewart. Our show is produced by Tedra Meyer and Andrea Lorien. Our call screener today was Rick Barrett. I'm Connor Cyrus. I appreciate you listening, and we'll talk again soon.